From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Americans keep dying in Iraq. Soldiers long to return home. Iraqi resistance grows more organized. Today brought high drama and a notch in the U.S. military's belt after a six-hour gun battle. Saddam Hussein's sons, Qusay and Uday, are confirmed dead. But this is not the quick, complete victory many anticipated. Daily attacks and fighting drag on, testing American tolerance for war casualties. Tonight on Point, guerrilla war and untangling the United States from Iraq. We begin with the latest from the United Nations, where members of the new Iraqi Governing Council today addressed the Security Council. The United Nations endorsement of the U.S.-picked Iraqi Council could be a first step toward international assistance in Iraq's reconstruction. Felicity Beringer is a U.N. correspondent for the New York Times. I asked her what was at stake at today's meeting.
I think the main issue for them was demonstrating in a public way that they are credible representatives of this new government, and this new governing council is a credible body.
And did they succeed?
They certainly presented themselves very well before the council. That is, the one gentleman who spoke, Adnan Pachachi, spoke about his hopes for what the council could accomplish. He talked about taking some of the hundreds of thousands of former Army personnel and reincorporating them into society, perhaps in construction. He talked about putting together new schools in the thousands. He talked about getting a new police force together. And most interestingly, he talked about creating a constitution or setting up a constitutional convention that would both reflect the Muslim culture of Iraq and that would also involve separation of church and state. The last thing about the Constitutional Convention came after the council meeting in a press conference, and it was Ahmed Shalabi, another representative of the council, who said that.
But it's good to know. And what response did these three get from the UN today?
Everybody was their usual diplomatic, cordial selves. There was no sense that these people were unwelcome. On the contrary, they were made very welcome. But there was also a level of correct distance. They were appearing not as representatives of a new government of Iraq. They were appearing as private citizens to sort of speak to the council on issues of the moment. That's a very fine distinction that's very important here, because this meeting today does not mean that the United Nations in any form is formally recognizing these three individuals as representatives of a new government of Iraq.
Is there a reluctance within the Security Council to do that because this is a U.S.-appointed council, or at what point might that bridge be crossed?
The answer to that question is going to become clear to us over the next 5-6 weeks or so. Yes, there is a reluctance right now because of the genesis of this council. It was formed at a moment when Iraq was under foreign occupation from the point of view of many of the countries in the United Nations, and therefore it needs to establish its bona fides as a genuine representative body that is working at the behest of the Iraqi people and in the interests of the Iraqi people. As the coalition tries to pull back to the extent it can from the process, as other countries do or don't become involved, as this constitutional convention that they spoke of gets underway, at that moment or somewhere along that continuum, I think there will be a moment when the Security Council does recognize a new government of Iraq and will seat its representatives.
Felicity, is the UN now considering taking a greater role in Iraq, and how did today's developments factor into that consideration?
There is very definitely an appetite here to take a greater role. It was spoken of by the Secretary General's Special Representative to Iraq, Sergio Vieira de Mello. It was spoken of by many of the Security Council members who talked today after Mr. de Mello gave his speech. The idea, I think, is the resolution under which Mr. Vieira de Mello went to Iraq and the resolution under which the provisional authority is quasi-recognized, that's Resolution 1483, is elastic as to the UN's role. And I think everybody, including the coalition, is interested in seeing the UN push the edges of that and try and have a greater and greater role The final issue, of course, is control of what happens, and certainly as far as security is concerned, everybody here believes that is still the responsibility of the provisional authority.
And what about Washington's attitude toward a greater UN role in Iraq?
A little harder to read, because when you say Washington, you speak as if it was a single voice. And I think what's been clear over the last few days is that there, as has been clear in the past, is that there are multiple voices speaking in Washington. I'm not sure the Bush administration has come to a decision as to what role they want the United Nations to play. The ambassador of the United States, John Negroponte, spoke today and made specific reference to the existing resolution, that's the one that was passed that lifted the sanctions, as giving other nations an umbrella under which they could come in. It's been clear from what the Indians have said publicly and the Russians have said publicly that this is not acceptable to them.
Kofi Annan has ruled out the possibility of a UN police force working side by side with U.S. troops. If the UN were to get more involved, if Washington, the Bush administration, opened the door to that, what kind of activities might the UN undertake in Iraq?
I think they could play several very important roles. They have in other countries. The UN has plenty of experience trying to get democratic processes going again. And so they can play an extremely useful advisory role in the formation of a new government. I stress that it would be an advisory role, but they've done this before. There are certain things you have to do. You have to get voters registered. You have to get a constitution that does seem to reflect both democratic ideals and the particular culture of the society in question. Also, human rights abuses. There obviously is a tremendous amount of wrong that has been done. The UN has a lot of experience in taking societies through the process of redressing those wrongs and coming to some resolution about the atrocities of the past.
And finally, is there any kind of timetable here, a defined period in which the UN might decide what it's going to do, whether it's going to be involved?
That's an excellent question. The word timetable is on every lip here, and nobody is giving a specific actual amount of time that things will take. There's a lot of very creative fudging going on the timeline, but everybody uses words like soon and as quickly as possible.
So correct and cordial, but still a kind of distance and lack of clarity about where this is going.
Cordial, some warmth, certainly still a lot of fog.
Felicity Beringer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Felicity Beringer is UN correspondent for the New York Times. She spoke with us from New York. U.S. soldiers have a long, tough battle ahead in Iraq, said military and strategic big thinker Boston University professor Andrew Bacevich in a provocative Los Angeles Times editorial yesterday. The United States is enmeshed in a guerrilla war that it can win, he writes, but it is a war that could drag on for years. Bacevich says Americans will have to be patient as casualties and costs mount to levels the Bush administration never anticipated. Are you confident the United States will ultimately prevail in Iraq? What will it take to move from a guerrilla war to genuine peace? And do you fear a quagmire in Iraq or expect a victory? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations at Boston University and a retired colonel and former commander of the U.S. Army's 11th Armored Cavalry. He is author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Bacevich.
Thanks very much.
So let's jump straight in. And I guess let me ask you before we even begin, you have watched the news all day like the rest of us as we see that Qusay and Uday Hussein, the sons of Saddam, are apparently dead. How consequential for the U.S. War effort, I guess we're still calling it, in Iraq?
Certainly it's good news. I think I would want to reserve any judgment about whether it has any sort of decisive significance. It's good news from my point of view, in particular because it says that we've got some kind of a functioning intelligence system. I think that the commander on the ground in Iraq said that this happened as a result of a walk-in tip.
Mm-hmm.
That may or may not be true. It doesn't matter. There was some intelligence that clearly fingered these guys, and good intelligence is key to a success in a guerrilla warfare. So that says we've got some kind of a system. and it's working. I'm skeptical about whether it's getting these two particular people is decisive, because nothing I have heard indicates that Uday and Kusei were in control of the guerrilla activities ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly to take out members of the family has an important symbolic significance, but whether it follows that somehow opposition now crumbles because the leadership has been taken out, I guess I'd have to wait and see on that.
You wouldn't go that far. It was just last week that General John Abizaid raised the guerrilla word, guerrilla resistance, guerrilla tactics, translated into headlines, guerrilla war. And, of course, that phrase has powerful resonance in the American mind, especially for anyone who lived through the Vietnam War era and saw the United States leave there effectively in defeat. Andrew Basevich, you write that Iraq is not Vietnam. You say that America's lengthy experience with guerrilla war suggests that quagmire and defeat are not inevitable in Iraq, but that a long, complex, and difficult war probably lies ahead. Is this guerrilla war, and how far into it are we?
Well, I accept that it's guerrilla war because, as you said, General Abizaid has candidly acknowledged that, and I think that's an important step forward. My sense is that the civilian leadership of the administration was, I guess for understandable reasons, somewhat reluctant to acknowledge that the great success of the conventional campaign didn't translate into this instantaneous liberation, peace, democracy, troops come home by Thanksgiving. So the fact that Abizaid, taking advantage of the fact that he was newly appointed to the job, and therefore is able to stand up and say,
"What's really
here's
on his
my
mind.
Here's my initial assessment. Here's what's going on." I'm sure he did that with Rumsfeld's concurrence.
Though Rumsfeld didn't like it and still chides reporters for using the phrase guerrilla war. Nevertheless, he said it. But your first reaction to that, or your considered reaction to that, is maybe so, probably so, but it's not a Vietnam. What gives you that confidence?
Well, it's not a Vietnam in the sense that let's talk a second about Vietnam and what made that challenge so particularly different. Well, one thing is sanctuaries, the sanctuary of North Vietnam as a source of manpower. That came into the South, and we chose for all kinds of reasons that we need not discuss here, a sanctuary that for all practical purposes, despite our ineffectual bombing of the North, we chose to honor.
Syria, Iran, the mountains of Iraq?
Well, I just as a place to go hide, yes, but as a place from which manpower, materiel, resupplies, ammunition is going to come. Doesn't look like it.
Okay.
But on that point also, yes, Syria could be a source of support for the guerrillas. Where is Syria going to get it? In Vietnam, there were other great powers.
China, the Soviet Union, happy
to
supply.
States. Exactly right. Well, that doesn't exist today. The Vietnamese were people who had a cause and they believed passionately in that cause. The people believed in that cause. It was the cause of Vietnamese nationalism for the most part.
Islam, Iraqi nationalism?
Well, the jury may still be out on that, but I think up to this point, we haven't seen evidence of the Iraqi people turning against the American occupation. Now, there's a significant subset of, it appears to be, fairly highly motivated, fairly well organized, fairly well armed, and increasingly skillful. Combatants who are going to contest our occupation, but it doesn't seem to me that the Iraqi people are in opposition at this point.
And with all that, you say, likely to be long, complex, difficult. It will try the patience of the American public and could get worse before it gets better.
Well, because my argument here is to say, look, it's not Vietnam, but it is guerrilla war. What do we know about guerrilla war? We actually have all kinds of experience with guerrilla war. And all of that experience, apart from Vietnam, says these kinds of wars tend to be long, ugly, expensive, difficult to measure progress.
We're going to come back and look at exactly that We're talking tonight with Andrew Bacevich. You can join the conversation as well. Are you confident that the United States will ultimately prevail in Iraq? And what will it take to bring the war in Iraq to a full end, to move guerrilla war to peace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about guerrilla war in Iraq and what it will take for the United States and its Iraqi allies to prevail. My guest tonight is Andrew Bacevich. He's professor of international relations at Boston University, a retired colonel and former commander of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, U.S. Army, author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. You can join the conversation as well. Do you fear a quagmire in Iraq, or do you expect a victory? And if you favored the war before it began, how do you feel about it now? How might you feel in 2005 if it's still going on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation now, joining us from Washington, D.C., Max Singer. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, an independent think tank. He's co-author of The Real World Order, Zones of Peace, Zones of Turmoil. Good evening and welcome, Max Singer.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. Max Singer, there's been an awful lot of criticism of the way this post-major combat operations period has unfolded so far. And as you know, a lot of hand-wringing about what now looks like, at least in the description of General John Abizaid, guerrilla war in Iraq. How have we started, and what's your expectation of where it goes from here?
Well, I think the first thing to think about is who we're fighting, and I think that's going to be changing. Right now, we're fighting the remnants of Saddam's regime. There's no sign at all that we're fighting a popular resistance or that there's any widespread desire among Iraqis to chase the United States out of Iraq.
And that, in your mind, is a good thing, is a positive thing.
Yeah, certainly. It's mm-hmm. And I think there's no doubt that we will, I think, in a matter of months, be able to capture or kill Saddam and largely eliminate this remaining resistance.
And what's the risk in your mind of a spark jumping from this remnant of Saddam's loyalists, as you describe them, to some part of the general population?
No, I don't think so. I think there's quite a different problem. There's two problems. There's the underlying problem of helping the Iraqis with the very difficult task of constructing a new united Iraq in which the different peoples there find a way to live together and to form a government. And that's a very difficult task. Mm. I think it's going to be made and is already beginning to be made much more difficult, and this is where I think the terror war or guerrilla war is not exactly the same, comes in. I think that the supporters of terror against the United States, principally Iran and Syria and Wahhabis, mostly from Saudi Arabia, have decided that the safest thing for them is to go after the United States in Iraq, where they think we are vulnerable, and indeed we have some vulnerability, rather than letting us have a success in Iraq and then turn to them in our own schedule.
So unlike Andrew Bacevich, you do see the possibility of this turning into a proxy war.
I see... Iranian and Syrian and Wahhabi agents in small numbers coming in and organizing divisive forces among the Iraqis and trying to organize anti-American movements among the Iraqis and to give them technical assistance in conducting terror operations against Americans and Iraqis and anybody else.
And how effective could that be? How long could that keep Americans tied down in Iraq?
Well, I think it depends principally on how quickly unity can be achieved among Iraqis. That not only determines the speed, it also determines the outcome. If we are giving support to a popular Iraqi regime against mm-hmm. minorities supported from outside, We can continue for a very long time and will ultimately prevail. If they succeed by a combination of divisive political appeals plus the conflict that comes from trying to put down terrorism in creating genuine anti-American feelings in a substantial part of the population, then we're likely to be in a situation in which we lose even if we win. So that the key to the whole thing is to help the Iraqis achieve this kind of unity.
To get that, to win the hearts and minds, to get people on board with a central Iraqi government. Andrew Bacevich, let me turn to you for a moment. You point out that the United States has a lot of experience with guerrilla war, starting with its own guerrilla war in the American Revolution and going right on through, as you describe it, Indian campaigns, the war in the Philippines, the Marines going into Nicaragua to put down Sandino's insurgency in the 20s, even the federal effort to subdue the Ku Klux Klan. Give us your quick list of issues that you see as you look out across guerrilla war and this guerrilla war. What are the surprises going to be? What are the facts going to be?
What are the surprises? What are the facts? I guess the key fact that springs out to me looking at the historical experience, and I would emphasize that it's not just our historical experience with guerrilla war, mm-hmm. but that of other democracies, mm-hmm. the British against the Boers, the French in Indochina, mm-hmm. the French in Algeria. The big thing is democracies have a tough time with these sorts of wars.
Because?
They have a tough time because they're long, because they're costly, because the reporters are walking up to the generals and the defense secretaries saying, are we winning? When is this going to be over? And those answers in guerrilla wars are particularly difficult to answer. It's
and in the Iraqi circumstance, what's your? Is there a rule of thumb? Are you looking at months? Are you looking at years? What would you guess?
Well, I think that Max Singer's remarks were dead on because, at least as I was interpreting them, there's still a lot of unknowns. There's still mm-hmm. a lot of things in play. One of the things that I mentioned in that L.A. Times piece is guerrilla wars are frustrating for the counter-guerrilla forces. And we all remember My Lai from the Vietnam experience.
The massacre of Vietnamese there by American troops.
That was not unique in American history in guerrilla wars. Guerrilla wars tend to, the purpose of guerrilla war in part is to incite regular soldiers to overreact.
To drive the big power mad in a way.
And should that happen, mm-hmm. we've got very disciplined soldiers, mm-hmm. albeit some of them are starting to get tired.
Yes.
But should that happen, then that can cause a sort of backlash in the Iraqi people that can complicate the problem.
And already
if
we're hearing Iraqi
saying. If I were directing mm-hmm. this guerrilla campaign, mm-hmm. that would be precisely what I would want to do. I want to get the Americans to use excessive firepower. That's why I want to attack them in cities. So they'll start shooting up the neighborhood, shooting innocent noncombatants, and that I can capitalize on that to begin to develop this popular antipathy to make a small guerrilla movement into something much more powerful.
So it'll take longer than people expect. You get frustrated soldiers who may do something ugly that
provokes popular
resistance.
It's going to be more costly. I mean, one of the interesting things that General Abizaid said, and when I was watching his presentation in the Pentagon the other day, was he said, if I need more troops, I won't hesitate to ask for them. Now, that was a forthright and important and I think honorable thing to say, mm-hmm. but I understood it that he was putting down a marker.
Saying heads up.
He's already thinking of that.
And there are 150,000 troops essentially there now.
Worse than that. And the measure that is a troubling measure is that there are today 33 combat brigades in the active component of the U.S. Army. 33.
Right. In total, everywhere, worldwide.
Worldwide. And 21 of those are either in Iraq already or committed elsewhere overseas and essentially are not available.
That leaves 9. Is that a problem in military terms?
Well, it's not a problem if all the troops are going to be home by Thanksgiving. But if indeed, as I expect, and I think many others expect, that this is now a multi-year proposition, We're not going to leave the troops that are there for the next 3 years. We've got to have the capacity to rotate fresh troops to replace those who are already there. And I think there are major questions about whether or not we have today sufficient troops to do that.
Max Singer, let me turn to you for just a moment here. That paints a picture of whatever you think of the scope of this conflict, a conflict that is already seriously impinging on the U.S. military's force strength, depth.
Well, I think that, well, it's true that a large number of troops are needed. I don't think it's true that they all have to be U.S. troops, and I'm not speaking of other foreign. I think that over the month, the main hope is that the Iraqis will provide a large part of the forces, and the U.S. troops can be less numerous and less sort of out there or just hanging around and being vulnerable and used more for specific missions.
But the U.S. has been very ambivalent about working with foreign troops in situations like this. American commanders have said if it's going to be a hot situation, we want our own chain of command and ideally our own troops.
Well, that's where they're starting now. But I think that as the Iraqi political basis increases and the Iraqi builds up a force, they will be more than happy to turn over many of these assignments, which fighting troops don't like to do, which are close to the police or gendarmerie,
mm-hmm.
And using the fighting troops for what they're best at. But on the other hand, let me make something on the negative side. Professor Bacevich has talked about the frustrations of guerrilla war, leading troops sometimes to do things that they shouldn't do, and that creates animosity. But even if they don't, even doing only things that they ought to be doing, the necessary procedures for fighting against terrorists tend to make you unpopular.
Doors get kicked down, bystanders do get hit.
That's right. People have to go through checkpoints. You have to be very suspicious of people. Somebody who approaches you and doesn't stop, you can't wait to see whether he's a suicide bomber. That business is a very nasty business, even if discipline is absolute.
Max Singer, Andrew Bacevich, stand by. A lot of people want to join this conversation. I want to turn to them. Daniel's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to first start out saying that I was opposed to the war, and I think I still am. But I had an interesting conversation with a coworker of mine who is from Uganda and lived through the days of Idi Amin.
Yes.
And she spoke at great length about how she really supports the war, and she thinks it was a good idea because it's terrible to live under a dictator and all the different things that go with that.
Okay, where does that leave us with guerrilla war?
Where that leaves us with guerrilla war, she believes that the weapons of mass destruction and the guerrilla war will end when we win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people, so they trust that America is not going away and the Ba'ath Party's coming back. Because they're sticking their necks too far out, and they have to worry about the previous power coming back in. And I mean, that's what Idi Amin did. Apparently, he went and
right.
And
so until they're sure that Saddam is not coming back, she thinks there could be some slippage there. Andrew Bacevich,
right.
let me put that to you. Daniel, thanks for that. I want to put it right to Andrew Bacevich, if I may, and thank you for your call. A tricky equation here. On the one hand, you want to make clear that the old regime is not coming back. On the other hand, we're already hearing Iraqis saying, we don't want you here. This is Iraq. This is our country. Go away.
Well, apart from the I also was opposed to the war, by the way. Apart from the guerrilla war aspect of this, although in a sense not to be separated from it in any meaningful sense, is the reconstruction, the building of this new Iraq. We've been blowing it. The first guy we picked, retired general.
Jay Gardner.
Who in many respects is a wonderful man, apparently wasn't up to the task. We have been very slow to deliver on promises and expectations that we have created. And quite frankly, if you would just cast your gaze over to Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and say, well, how are we doing there, given a little bit longer period of time, it seems to me most people would say we haven't fulfilled our promises there either. Major problem.
So that doesn't lead to great public support. Ali's calling from Boston. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The last caller was right on the money. I'm originally from Iran, and I'm familiar with the culture with both Iraq and Iran.
All right.
Being Shiite. One of the things that we're simply missing out is very simple acts that we can conduct within the society to engage with the society of Iraq.
Such as?
Simply, on the religious holidays of Shia holidays or whichever, the Islamic holidays in Iran, what they do, the vendors, local vendors, they feed the people just locally. Nothing big, nothing major, there's no order coming up from the top to the bottom. It's just, that's their advertising, actually. They're not doing it for the love of God. They're advertising for their own businesses, for their own connections, for their own consumers. And they put the good name out that Haji such and such fed the people in the streets and did this and did that.
So, Ali, are you saying that trying to build a new government and get the electricity back up and the sewerage repaired and food supplies in general flowing is not enough? The U.S. military needs to be passing out free bowls of rice?
We need marketing, Tom. We need marketing. That's what we're missing. We're not selling the idea. We're doing all the good stuff, but people are not hearing it. We need to get the message across and show it to them with the way that they can understand it and they can engage with us rather than say, oh, these people are coming to the country, kicking the doors down, and they're looking at our woman and all this stuff.
Right.
And that's the idea, I think.
Ali, we've got it, and we appreciate your view from that perspective. Max Singer, what about it? You described the doors that have to be kicked down. Can that be counteracted with Ali calls it marketing or psyops, or you tell us how to describe it. Is there more that ought to be done, could be done, that might shorten this conflict in the way of military interaction with the Iraqi people?
Well, I think the important thing to recognize is that while the Iraqis have been saying we would like to govern ourselves, they have not been saying we want the United States to go home. A few voices, but principally expatis or people encouraged from the outside. But the clear sense of the Iraqi people is that they do not want the Americans to go home. They have a lot they want the Americans to do, a great deal. We should be doing a better job of getting it to them, but gradually we will. But the main thing is that the Iraqis have to create, and we have to cooperate in every way, a Iraqi politics and an Iraqi government. Part of this is representatives building up this provisional council in the meantime and beginning to work right away toward writing a constitution so they can go into a regular politics. That's the dominating issue. Mm-hmm.
Easy to say, obviously, hard to do. Andrew Bacevich, how would you grade the U.S. effort so far in terms of demonstrating to Iraqis that this relationship is one they want to hang in with?
Well, of course, it's very difficult for us to judge as distant observers. And, I mean, I read the newspapers like you read the newspapers. The newspapers give us the bad news, not the good news. But having said that, I mean, it strikes me that at best we're doing a C-minus kind of an effort. Part of the problem here is a military mindset issue. The military, and in particular the Army, has been reluctant institutionally to embrace the notion that it doesn't just fight wars, but it has a major role to be played after the war in
rebuilding
the
nations. We've got to take a short break. Are you confident the U.S. will prevail in Iraq? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about guerrilla war in Iraq and what it will take for the U.S. and its Iraqi allies to prevail. Are you confident that the U.S. will prevail in Iraq? Do you fear a quagmire or expect a victory? And how many American lives are you prepared to feed into this conflict? And how much money? And how many years? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight from Washington, D.C., Max Singer, senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. And here with me in the studio, Andrew Bacevich, teaches international relations at Boston University. You can join the conversation as well, 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Boston. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yeah, good afternoon. I'd like to say that at first, it's not so much that America is prevailing, but humanity as a whole. It's the next generation that's going to prevail in this. And my question is, you know, how can you put a time frame on this process that could take years, if not decades, for the people to get used to the freedom in a democratic government with a justice system, with a real political system?
Are you suggesting U.S. troops in Iraq in guerrilla war for decades?
Hey, you know, if you look at after World War II, we still have troops in Japan. We still have troops in Germany. We didn't just, like, leave these areas, and I don't think that we're going to be leaving this area anytime soon either.
I don't think that
it's just America. As time goes on, you've got people like Germany and Japan that both have suspended their constitutions and have started raising some sort of an armed force to be more active in this.
So you're expecting maybe others as well, but you're saying it may take a long time and we've got to do it. Andrew Bacevich, I mean, interesting on several fronts here. One, in this situation, also another difference from Vietnam, the United States strategically, as I see it, really can't leave here without success, really cannot walk away from Iraq. Our caller, John, says, look, we've had troops in Germany and Japan for decades. Of course, we didn't have guerrilla war in those countries for decades. But how do you think in the largest terms about duration of commitment here and how much of that duration might be time in which American soldiers are dying in this country?
I think part of the issue here is this gets to, in some senses, to the dishonesty that underlies the basis for going to war. We're getting a suggestion of that dishonesty in the whole effort to find weapons of mass destruction, in the bogus statements inserted in the State of the Union address, mm-hmm. and so on. But there's a larger element of dishonesty, and that is that I believe, and there is some evidence for this, that at least for some proponents of the war in the Bush administration, there was no expectation that we were going to leave anytime soon.
It's a one-way ticket in.
That in a sense, John's right, yes. Just as we are in Germany 50 years after World War II, there would be an expectation that the overthrow of Saddam Hussein would make possible the entry of U.S. military power into this region in a much larger and more permanent way. Not the expectation we were going to get shot at,
mm-hmm.
but the expectation that Iraq then would become an American client, a friendly state, a place from which to project American power and influence in the region.
As oil stocks dwindle?
No, not because we're trying to capture the world's oil supply, but because we intended to use this war as the lever to begin a larger campaign to transform the Arab world and to therefore eradicate radical Islam, which is the essence of the problem in the war on terror.
Well, let's just accept that for a moment. How does guerrilla war then fit into that long-term plan?
Guerrilla war says that if in a sense, Iraq was phase one in this larger strategy, that getting to phase two and phase three is going to take a heck of a lot longer and it's going to cost a lot more because we find ourselves bogged down fighting a war in Iraq, an unconventional war in Iraq, after the conventional war was supposed to solve the problem.
And worse, doesn't it risk provoking the rest of the region rather than winning it over or beating it over to the American side?
Again, how this thing continues to play, how it plays out over the next several months is something that I wouldn't want to predict and is crucially important, but democracies tend not to do real well in guerrilla wars, so that sort of downside concern that you talk about is at least plausible.
Max Singer, doesn't that raise a quite, at one level, frightening sort of witch's brew here? If the United States has to be in this region, has to be in this country, but can't guarantee that the guerrilla war goes away anytime soon, not only American soldiers' lives then are on the line, but the U.S. relationship with the region that as Andrew Bacevich would have it, many in the administration hope this would improve.
Well, I think that the U.S. was not trying to make client states except in the sense that Germany and Japan are client states now that they are democracies. I don't think that the United States went in there because it was interested in having a large military presence, and we demonstrated there that from outside we had ample military force. The problem is the political problem, and we were interested in working against supporters of terrorism, which is, I think, not a very selfish or shameful goal, or even one which should be denied by the people there. So that is what we're engaged in, and what's happened is that the other supporters of terrorism decided to come in and have the fight in Iraq rather than somewhere else. I think we're going to have to respond. Mm. Democracies may not be very good at defending in guerrilla warfares, although they often win. But what we are very good at is we are a revolutionary power. We're very good at promoting democracy when we decide to do that. And all the countries that are attacking us in Iraq are very vulnerable. They are unpopular, unrepresentative governments with great vulnerability at home, both ethnic and political.
But that makes it sound as though we're talking about taking on the whole Middle East.
Pardon me?
That makes it sound as though we may be taking on the whole Middle East described in those ways, and I don't know if that makes defeating the guerrilla situation in Iraq easier or harder. I want to get another call. Paul's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First, I want to object strongly to the use of Germany as an example. Our troops are not there to keep down unrest in Germany. They're there for the Cold War reasons. The other thing I'd
But of course, when they first arrived, it was, you know, right on the back of a victory.
Of course. But the caller was using an example to say that, you know, we're still in Germany. And, you know, after 50 years, we're not there for those reasons.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the United States has been there as long as it felt it had a strong strategic interest in being
exactly.
there. The Cold War, you're right. Nevertheless, it could see a strategic line running now through Iraq, as Andrew Bacevich says. But your larger point, Paul?
Larger point is I predict things are going to be a lot worse than people, you know, this conversation seems to indicate, because people are saying that the Iraqi people are supportive of the United States. However, it's just these remnants of Saddam's forces that are against us there.
We heard that earlier from Max Singer. What do you think?
I get my information from the Internet, and I primarily listen to eyewitness reports. And all of those have indicated that, you know, as soon as people turn their backs, you know, there was one example of an American soldier killed. They erected a small gravestone, and as soon as the Americans left, it was trashed. You know, by kids, by women, by, you know.
So you do fear popular resistance, Paul, and I hear that loud and clear. Andrew Bacevich, where do you see this line running? Clearly, there is a large remnant of Ba'athist Party elements in Iraq, but just as clearly, there's the danger of this spilling over into popular resistance. Where does it stand?
I really don't have a good sense of popular opinion. But again, the significance of General Abizaid describing this as guerrilla war was an indication that their analysis has now led them to believe that it's not simply a handful of Ba'athist dead-enders, that there is something more cohesive, there's something more dangerous. It may not have risen to the level where this movement commands popular support, but they have concluded it's a heck of a lot more dangerous than Mr. Rumsfeld was suggesting as recently as 2 weeks ago.
Andrew Bacevich, riddle us this. How can Americans gauge the progress of this conflict? How can they try to measure whether or not it's going well, going toward success?
That's, again, one of the great difficulties that guerrilla war poses for democracies. When the conventional campaign was underway, you know, we could say the objective is Baghdad, and today we are within 45 miles,
mm-hmm.
and the next day we're within 30 miles.
Clicking down the miles.
And that's a persuasive way of showing and reassuring us that things are on track. There are no such convenient measures in guerrilla warfare. There aren't necessarily big battles. The keys, we haven't been able to fully identify the leadership of this movement, if it qualifies mm-hmm. as that. But the key to success may be to identify it and destroy the leadership. The key may well be to win the hearts and minds of the people, which again is easy to say, tough to do, and extraordinarily difficult, really, to measure.
Are you confident that we'll be given an honest picture of what's going on there by the U.S. military?
Well, I'm confident that the military guys will call it the way they see it. We are entering the political season. I'm not confident that the politicians will be equally honest.
Andrew Bacevich, thank you for joining us tonight. And Max Singer, thank you very much for joining us from Washington.
You're welcome.
Max Singer is senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and co-author of The Real World Order. Andrew Bacevich is a retired colonel and former commander of the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, U.S. Army. He's author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, and professor at Boston University. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. In a moment, Jessica is home. This is On Point. Thousands of well-wishers, dozens of marching bands, and throngs of news media welcomed Private Jessica Lynch back home to rural West Virginia today. The 20-year-old Army supply clerk captured national attention when she was wounded, captured, and later rescued in Iraq earlier this year. Questions about the source of her injuries and the necessity of her dramatic rescue have been since raised. Today in Wirt County, however, flocks of supporters turned out to greet Lynch, who has been undergoing treatment for multiple broken bones and other injuries since early April. Private Lynch addressed the crowd today from a wheelchair.
Hi, thank you for being here. It's great to be home. I would like to say thank you to everyone who hopes and prayed for my safe return. For a long time, I had no idea so many people knew I had been missing. But I read thousands of letters, many of them from children, who offer messages of hope and faith. I would like to thank the people in this community, especially those who gave donations to the Lynch Fund and who volunteered their time and skills to work on my family's house. Please allow me to thank the doctors, nurses, and staff members of Walter Reed Army Medical Center for the excellent care they gave me. I'd like to thank the staff of Landstuhl Medical Center in Germany for their care and support. I'd like to thank the Fisher Foundation, Governor Bob Wise, and United States Senator Jay Rockefeller for the roles they played in helping my family to be with me in Germany and Washington. I'm also grateful to several Iraqi citizens who helped save my life while I was in their hospital. And then a unit of our Special Forces soldiers did save my life. I want to thank Sergeant Reuben Contreras. Reuben, you never let me give up. When I wanted to quit PT, you kept me going. And you're my inspiration, and I love you. I'm proud to be a soldier in the Army. I'm proud to have served with the 507th. I'm happy that some of the soldiers I served with made a home alive, and it hurts that some of my company didn't. Most of all, I miss Lori Payeskova. She was my best friend. She fought beside me, and it was an honor to have served with her. Lori will always remain in my heart. I've read thousands of stories that said when I was captured, I said, I'm an American soldier too. Those stories were right. Those were my words. I am an American soldier too. Thank you for this welcome, and it's great to be home.
Private Jessica Lynch speaking this afternoon near Little Kanawha River in Wirt County, West Virginia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.